Thank you, everyone, again, for your patience in joining today. We have a bit of a late start, but we will get there. Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to our annual Grand Central Forum. It's a time when we as a community come together in colloquy to discuss important issues of the day. And in truth, community takes on greater meaning in these times. With that, allow me to thank our delegates for joining us today and bearing with the technical difficulties. We're speaking about the future of international arbitration. To answer that, we'll take a look at where we were, where we are now, to inform where we're headed, the next normal. We approach the topic with an all-star group who are known to you, thought leaders in the field, with a focus on Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. Each wears several hats within the international arbitration community, and they'll share their insights on how we pivot or have pivoted and what the nuances are that are here to stay. Turning to our speakers, Nadia Darwazé is head of the arbitration practice at Clyde & Co.'s Paris office. She serves as counsel and arbitrator in commercial and investment arbitrations, and she has practiced in Paris, London, Frankfurt, and Shanghai. Alexander Faces is Secretary General of the ICC Court and Director of ICC Dispute Resolution Services. He is responsible for the operational management and coordination of the ICC Court's Secretariat. Emmanuel Gaillard is founder of Sherman and Sterling's International Arbitration Practice, where he is head of global disputes and head of the International Arbitration Practice Group. Emmanuel is professor of law in France and also a visiting professor of law at Harvard and Yale. And Catherine Rogers, she's an international scholar in arbitration and a professor in ethics. She teaches at Queen Mary University and Penn State. She is the founder and CEO of Arbitrator Intelligence, and a plug here for that. It's a fabulous, innovative module created to increase transparency, accountability, and diversity in arbitration. I'll place a hyperlink in the chat for that if you're not familiar with it. She is also a member of NIAC's Global Advisory Board. Last but not least, Daniel Schimmel, this afternoon's conductor. Daniel is a partner at Foley Hoag. He leads the International Arbitration and Litigation Practice in their New York office, and he also serves as independent arbitrator in addition to his counsel work. Daniel is one of our directors at NIAC, and he leads the program committee. Two administrative points. The session is being recorded, and it will soon upload to NIAC's audio library. To increase audience participation, at the end of session, after the speakers have presented, we're going to ask you to use the raise hand function. You'll be unmuted, not to worry, your video will not go live, and you can pose your questions directly to the speakers. As you have questions during the substantive session, feel free to posit those in the Q&A function within Zoom. And with that, we are off. Thanks so much to the Foley team. Daniel, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Reka. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Grand Central Forum. We heard this morning in the session involving Asia that virtual hearings show the responsiveness and the flexibility of the arbitration community. And so one of the questions that we ask is whether the pandemic has accelerated a trend in international arbitration. Whether once the health crisis is over, we will see more procedural conferences and oral arguments held virtually by video conferencing, whether we will see more evidentiary hearings held virtually, and if yes, whether that involves a different kind of advocacy, more focused advocacy because of Zoom fatigue. We will also address the cost and efficiency issues of virtual hearings and address whether there are cultural and regional considerations, differences. In other words, do lawyers and arbitrators in Europe And the United States have different views on some of these issues, as well as on enforcement. So the first topic we will address is procedural conferences and oral arguments. And Nadia will lead the way with this, and then we'll have a dialogue among the various speakers. So Nadia, do you feel that we are going to see, once the crisis is over, do you feel that we're going to see more procedural conferences and oral arguments held virtually? Give us your thoughts.
Thank you, Daniel. First of all, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I'm really glad to be with friends and colleagues on this panel. And let me give you this answer. My answer is yes, I do think that because of the pandemic, we are going to, what we've experienced during the pandemic, I think there's going to be a shift in how we conduct procedural hearings. I mean, if we take a step back, I would say in recent years, it's become quite common to hold procedural hearings by teleconference in any event. But I would say the default was still, you would think about it. You'd be like, okay, we have a procedural hearing. Are we going to do it by telephone or maybe video, more telephone, really, in my experience, or are we going to do it live? And so we were thinking about it. You know, the default wasn't, we'll do it virtually or remotely. And I think that's gonna shift. I would say that there will be a real shift there during the pandemic or after the pandemic, whenever we get there. And the reason is, I think, simply that we've now all had the experience of doing these procedural hearings. There was no choice. So everyone's been doing it. And I think what's come out of it is that procedural hearings, you can do them perfectly well by video call. And it's interesting because in the past, we would do them more by telephone call. And I think what we've learned now during the pandemic, and I think the default now is always to do video. Sometimes I even think, actually, I'd rather do a telephone call, but you only get video invitations. So, but because of this default to video calls, we've now understood that actually, or we've all gained solid experience of doing these procedural hearings by video, and that works perfectly well. So I predict that in future, the default is going to be, the assumption is going to be, it's going to be by video, or it's going to be done remotely. And then we might think, or are there good arguments here? Are there particular issues here? Why we should be doing it live? So, you know, such issues could be, well, it's a particularly contentious case. And so, you know, having, or perhaps one of the counsels not very familiar with arbitration, so there needs to be a bit more guidance there. And in those circumstances, the tribunal and the parties might say, actually, we're going to do the procedural hearing also live because maybe we can calm the spirits, if you will. Maybe we can reassure parties that this arbitration is going to be conducted on an equal footing. We're going to be able to provide guidance, the tribunal say, to the parties that are not as familiar with arbitration. And in those circumstances, it might make sense to have a live arbitration just to ensure that everyone trusts the process, that parties get a sense of who the arbitrators are and are comfortable with the process going forward. But I would predict otherwise, unless there is those exceptional circumstances, or say if everyone is in New York or Paris anyway, and it's not very cost, it doesn't have a major cost, in fact, then you can also have it live. But otherwise, I would say the default is having it remotely. The big advantage really is, and that's why I think it's also attractive to have this procedural hearing remotely, is that provides for a lot more flexibility. You know, I was supposed to have a procedure hearing today. It got canceled at the very last minute. And normally that would be a much bigger deal because people would have traveled. There were good reasons why it was canceled, and now we'll probably just do it next week. So the procedure, I think the fact that it's virtual also just gives us a lot more flexibility.
A question, how about midstream conferences, such as, for instance, Kaplan openings, where they're not very often used in the U.S., but a Kaplan opening can happen after the first merit submissions are made. And it's an opportunity to have a dialogue with the arbitrator, both sides, and look at the relevant issues and focus the rest of the proceedings. Do you see an increase in those? Do you expect there will be an increase in those? And is there value in them?
So I would say that I haven't seen an increase in those during the pandemic, but then the pandemic hasn't been that long, thankfully. But I don't think that we are going to see an increase, and I'll tell you why. For me, theoretically, there should be an increase, because now that you have a lot more flexibility with having these oral hearings by video or remotely, let's say just remotely, there's nothing to prevent the tribunal from saying, listen, after we've received the first set of submissions from the parties, it's not going to be that difficult to schedule, even with busy arbitrators, a two-hour slot or a half-a-day slot where we discuss where we get a first impression from the parties about the issues, right? So you could say, well, that's going to be a lot less complicated. So from a theoretical point of view, there should be more of those midstream conferences, because it's going to be logistically much easier. But I would say that it's unlikely that there's going to be more of those, because what is required is arbitrators who are really on top of the case as the case progresses, right? And so the question is, are arbitrators going to be reading the first two submissions, and are they going to say, okay, listen, we want to do this midstream conference, and it's going to be so much easier now because we have virtual hearings, and so let's do it. I don't think that's actually going to incite the arbitrators to hold these. I think the arbitrators that were going to do it, because they believe that it's an efficient way of structuring the process, they're going to do it no matter what, whether it's live or whether it's virtual. Maybe there's more of an incentive to do it if you're sort of hesitating because you have this virtual opportunity. But many of the arbitrators were never going to do Kaplan hearings to begin with, whether virtually or live. So I'm not sure it's going to have as much of an impact, I would say, on those types of hearings. It will really depend on the arbitrators.
We'll hear from the other panelists in a minute. This morning in the conversation about Asia with arbitrators there, there was more of an interest for Kaplan openings, but maybe because they're happening more often in that area, and arbitrators, as you said, are more used to it. How about summary dispositions in arbitration? Do you feel there's going to be an increase in the requests and separate question, increase in the number of cases where they'll be granted?
Yeah, I think there is going to be an increase in requests. In fact, I've seen myself in my practice, whether as counsel or arbitrator, an increase there. And I think there was a Freshfield study that said that that's been perceived as the most innovative feature in arbitration, one of the most innovative features in international arbitration, the sort of summary disposition that certain institutions now provide for. So I think there will be an increase there. Justified or not justified is a different matter. Sometimes it could also be delay tactics and having yet another application. But no matter, whether justified or not, I think there will be an increase. Whether the fact that we do hearings virtually is going to have an impact on that, I don't really think so. I don't know if that's part of your question, Daniel, but I think there will be an increase, but I think it's more to do with the fact that it's something that's now become part of the toolkit, if you will, or the toolbox, rather, in international arbitration, and not so much related, I think, to the pandemic, because at the end of the day, the arbitrators will still, you have to prove your case, and the arbitrators will have to decide, well, actually, this is a case that is suited for this kind of decision, and that is really doesn't depend on what we've been going through or not, I would say.
So let's hear from other panelists on this topic. Emmanuel, do you have comments on these points that we just discussed?
Yes, I agree completely with Nadia. I mean, we all know that the pandemic has one good aspect, at least it's an accelerator of change, and we are going to make a 10-year leap or 15-year leap by contracting habits which now all of us start to like. And certainly for procedural hearings, I've seen obscene, I can use that word, obscene procedural meetings where we all go to a place, be it London, Singapore, New York, for 2-hour meeting just to discuss a draft procedural order number one. And it's ridiculous. I can send you pictures of that with tons of people coming, you know, each of us losing 3 days, and it's completely ridiculous. And I certainly hope that in the past we are not going to see that anymore. As to the Kaplan openings, I don't see it much in Europe yet, but I would like to see it, because any excuse to get the arbitrators to read the file early is good. And now they don't have the excuse of the cost. Well, it would be costly to bring everyone. No, it would not. It would be a 2-hour, half a day meeting. And now they just have the laziness excuse and no longer the cost excuse. So these are my remarks on this.
Great. Thank you. Catherine, what are your thoughts on this?
So I can only agree with what's been said so far and add not only cost, but now we're seeing a lot of pressure towards greener arbitrations or to greening our professional practices generally. I think one thing that's been implicit in both Emmanuel and Nadia's comments are the new professional challenges for arbitrators. So Nadia talked about, you know, reassuring the parties that they're going to have a fair hearing. So it's not just a matter of arbitrators having a technical competence, but their ability to, in a sense, convey that confidence and competence in a new format that's not necessarily as intuitive or doesn't rely on some of the normal trappings. And then I think, as Emmanuel said, it's also going to put a lot of pressure on them to be more efficient, because they can be a little more nimble in how they schedule things. And the pressure on that, I think, might be important as well. So I do think not everyone's in love with Zoom. It is exhausting in many respects, but it does add a flexibility. And I think it's part of the larger trend we've been seeing also in arbitration generally, to the sort of lack of, or getting away from the physicality. I mean, it wasn't so many years ago that arbitrators actually had to travel to the seat to sign the award physically. So the physicality of arbitration generally, I think, has been on the wane, and the pandemic just, as I think Gaia said, perfectly accelerates that.
All right. Alex, what are your thoughts on this first
topic? Thank you. Thank you, Daniel, and greetings to everyone. Good afternoon. I can only echo what has already been shared by my fellow co-panelists and yourself. I think we are seeing an exponential acceleration of our awareness and ability to use technology to boost efficiency in arbitration. I think it's also telling that all of my fellow panelists have actually emphasized the role of arbitrators in that. I don't wish to qualify that at all. I will fully sign the same petition. But I would like to note that actually part of this might actually be completely consensual. And that's one of the trends that we're seeing today. There is some consensus. I wouldn't say, you know, across the board, and if one needs to look into regional divisions, then probably there's work to be done in certain parts of the world over others. But there is certainly additional awareness from the parties with regard to the efficiency. I mean, we do hear that parties primarily care about predictability in arbitration and efficiency in arbitration. And I think we're speaking on the latter today. And I think that in that sense is a lot that that our times during the pandemic as practitioners have actually demonstrated. There's one thing that I would like to add, perhaps very briefly. It touches upon both the procedural conferences, oral arguments, and the evidentiary hearings. So I won't go very deep into it. As you know, we just approved amendments to the ICC rules that will come into effect next year. And while the amendments themselves were not triggered from the pandemic itself and our experiences through it, they were certainly enriched by it. And one of the things that we heard in reaching out to corporates is that decisions, when arbitrators need to take decisions with regards to whether to switch a hearing for what is what considered today the traditional norm or was considered to be the traditional norm, namely, let's all meet in Singapore or Paris or New York and hear the case together. They should actually be doing that not on the basis of their own availability, but on the basis of the facts of the case and the necessities of the case. And this was something that was emphasized by large corporates and small alike. I think this also demonstrates that the greater need for efficiency really needs to be tailored to the requirements of the case. And I will probably be dull in repeating this throughout our meeting today, but I do believe it is important.
Great. Thank you. So let's turn to the second large topic, which are evidentiary hearings. Emmanuel, you described the pandemic as an accelerator of change. Do you feel that once the health crisis is over, we'll see more evidentiary hearings conducted virtually by Zoom or otherwise?
I certainly hope so, because that meets one of the major criticisms the users have towards arbitration, which is cost. And frankly, even before the pandemic, for instance, I chaired the tribunal some time ago, but not so long ago, before the pandemic, where we had witnesses who had to come from the Middle East to Paris for a 1 hour video, you know, 1 hour cross-examination, and one party wanted it to be remote, the other resisted. And I said remote, and frankly, the cross-examination actually took 15 minutes. And we saved 3 days of, you know, travel cost and time and the like. So I really hope that it's maybe not becomes the default, like for procedural meetings, it should be the default, it should be remote. For the evidentiary hearings, it should be a serious option to consider, and because it can cut the cost significantly. Nadia alluded to the flexibility. One thing we have not said so far is that it gives the flexibility to have the final hearing, the closing argument, I mean, not at the end of the evidence, but it can be a week later, it can be 2 weeks later. It makes no difference. It's just much more comfortable and still fresh in everybody's mind. And that's something which is a plus. So you don't have to prepare it, you know, every evening to say that on Friday we are going to have the closing argument. You can have it just a week later and do it a bit more comfortably. At the same time, the tribunal cannot say, well, no, we cannot reconvene. It's a problem. You know, all this flexibility is good. And I think we should use it, not so much because we get used of what we are doing now, but because it meets the major concern of the users, which is cost.
How about whether it creates a new kind of advocacy? Whether, for instance, cross-examinations need to be more focused, look at fewer documents because on Zoom there's some fatigue and it's difficult to look at documents for hours and hours on the screen. What do you think about that?
Yes, it does. I think it does. I mean, first, you cannot cut off the participants as easily, so you have to be more orderly and more polite, I would say. Which is a problem for litigators, of course, but you get used to it, and you have to be more selective. The analogy for me, having done it now for a few months and lots of hearings, evidentiary hearings, including cross examinations. At first, you know, so that the cross examination is the part which people are reluctant to do remotely. Say, your initial reaction is, I can argue remotely. That's not going to make a big difference, but a cross-examination, you know, you have to get, But in fact, it works. And it's the analogy is like doing it with consecutive translation or with translation. You have to cut the what is not essential and go straight to what is important. And after all, it's not a bad discipline, because of course we all know that virtually the days are shorter because of time lag or simply because of it's just more tiring. So you have to be more efficient. After all, it's not a bad trend.
And how about the possibility of asymmetrical hearings when people are in different geographical regions of the world, where the tribunal sits with one side on procedural or legal issues and there's a transcript, and then the tribunal sits with the other side and a transcript is made? Have you seen any of this? Do you feel there's any place for it in arbitration?
I have not seen it, and I don't want to see it, because I really have a problem with that, because it's one, you know, having the video after the fact, it's not just like being present and being able to object, because the damage is done if you don't object on time. So I think it may create a due process problem, and I would have a problem with that. Also, we have all kinds of techniques. When the witness, for fact witnesses, sometimes it's useful to have one of the participants or one of the firm member or a friend in the country in which the participant is, the witness is located, be present in the room to avoid the suspicion of having prompting. But you know, in some difficult situations, that may be necessary. But I would think that due process is still there. And I think like sort of asymmetrical, what you call asymmetrical hearings, I would have really a problem with.
And last question, things like hot tubbing of expert witnesses, do you feel that it's easier to conduct them in virtually, or it makes no difference?
I think it makes no difference on that. I think you can conduct them virtually, you can have them on the screen, and then the tribunal can ask the question just if you had the two of them sitting in the middle of the room. I mean, I don't think it would make a big difference. I think the big difference is for the difficult fact witness. For experts, it's like advocacy, you know. It's a bit like oral argument. I mean, for technical experts or quantum or that. Maybe the most difficult issue is the fact witness who can lie or can be prompted, or when something turns, something real, not just a bit here or there, a bit, you know, nuance, but something real turns on a fact, and the testimony can be extremely crucial. In that case, I think having someone from the other side's team in the room present, or affiliated lawyer, it's a passive role, actually, just to see that nothing fishy is taking place. That would be useful. But with that caveat, I don't see many, many situations where it makes a huge difference. The huge difference is in terms of efficiency. And I think we should all have to take stock of the efficiency, possibilities which this gives us.
I agree with that, and on the use of observers, I sat recently as chair in an evidentiary hearing with parties and witnesses in six different countries. It was virtual, and there were observers in the room. The cross-examination, as you said, was done virtually, but there were observers in the room, and the process worked really well. The technology worked. The parties did a great job organizing the hearing, and it was seamless.
It's my experience as well. It works pretty well, and you know, not so much turns on a cross examination of a fact witness. I mean, that often, and in any event, I mean, they are prompted. You know, the prompting the day before they rehearsed anyway, so the prompting is not going to make a huge difference in many cases. But in some cases it does, and that's the technique to be followed, I think. And it does work. And we also had semi-remote hearings where, and that's also a good idea, I liked it, where the participants in Paris, those who were in Paris were in at the ICC premises, and those who were in an African country were connected by video. They were in a room physically, so it was semi-virtual, simply no travel. So you had a half of the team in Paris, half of the team in Douala in that case, and that worked very well with big screens. The ICC technology, thank you, Alex, works very well. So we it worked very well. But in that case, the beauty of it is that half of the teams were in Paris on both sides, and half of the team were in Douala. Because if you have one team in Paris with the tribunal and one team in Douala far, that would not work. It would create an imbalance. But if not, that's also a possibility, even with several cities. And that's, you don't have, if you do that, you don't have the Zoom fatigue. It's okay to look at the big screen for 10, 11 hours. It's not okay to do a real Zoom for 10 hours, I think. So we, oddly enough, we had a lot of it. It was through video, but it was not as tiring to have a full screen and to have the other participants. But again, it takes special circumstances, and certainly you cannot have one party with the tribunal, the other side being remote.
So let me ask our panelists how they feel about evidentiary hearing. Nadia, how do you feel about this topic and whether we're going to see more of them in the future, held virtually?
I think it would depend on how you ask me. Do you ask me as an arbitrator or do you ask me as counsel? And this is something that I found. When you speak to your friends who are arbitrators, and that includes me, I love the hearings remotely. It works swimmingly well. You know, the cross examinations are more focused. There's no time lost. You don't have to travel. It's, you know, especially when you know your co-arbitrators, you know the parties. I think it works really well. I recently had a hearing, for example. I think there were 30 people on the call. We had, it was in three, you know, parties in three continents. We had translators, a consecutive translation. And it worked swimmingly well. It was really great. And what I found interesting, so I was arbitrator in that case. I was presiding the tribunal. And what I found really interesting was how, and I didn't expect this as much, how you were actually able to build rapports even through Zoom. You know, you think it's sort of very skeptical, but actually you're able to build rapport with the people, with the counsel, you know, co-arbitrators you may know already. So that I thought was a really good experience. That worked very well. If you ask me as counsel, I've also done it as counsel, I do think as counsel it is more difficult because you have the added stress of the, you know, is the technology going to work? Like on this call, you know, our participants had to wait because we were 15 minutes late because we had a technical issue. But, you know, you do have that underlying stress. Maybe once we know that there's not going to be an issue, then we'll be more relaxed. And you have to become more experienced in how you use the documents that you use for cross-examination. I think it takes more practice than what we're used to. But I think that is a question of practice, and we are getting more and more practice in it. So ultimately, I think it's also going to go swimmingly well as counsel. I think it's a bit more difficult as counsel, but, you know, we'll get there. We're already getting there, and we'll get there. So I think that the answer is different whether you ask an arbitrator or as counsel in part. I definitely think that for evidentiary hearings on smaller cases, however you want to draw small cases, I think virtual hearings are the way forward because it does represent a big saving in terms of time and cost. It also allows you to go quicker. So definitely, I think for larger cases, I see there being more maybe hybrid type hearings, something that Emmanuel alluded to, where, you know, you might have certain people, there'll be more willingness to hear witnesses remotely that are perhaps having difficulties traveling, whereas perhaps before COVID, we were still fighting over whether they should appear in person. Now we'll be like, okay, we can do this more on a hybrid basis, and that works. The one thing that I do find that's a bit, just to throw a new element in there, I do think having a live hearing also has the benefit of bringing the clients together, which can sometimes also be useful if you want to engage in, say, settlement facilitation or in reconnecting them. And sometimes, not, you know, it doesn't happen very often, but it can happen that the parties getting together at the hearing, whether at the procedural hearing or even at the merits hearing, can have the parties sort of engage in a discussion again. And that, of course, won't be possible if you do it remotely. So those are some of my thoughts on evidentiary hearings.
And I, as you were speaking, there was a question from one of the participants, Keith Skolnick, who was asking, when you have these sort of hybrid situations where you have observers in a room and the hearing held virtually, are people wearing masks to protect themselves? I'll ask the panelists. I'll give you, you know, my experience on the hearing that recently closed. They were wearing masks. They were at a social distance in the back. But as Emmanuel said, they were making sure that nothing funny was taking place, that the witness was testifying and in a straight manner. And it helps the tribunal then makes credibility determinations, because you don't have to worry about is something strange taking place in the room. That was my experience. But Nadia or Emmanuel, would you like to comment on that question?
Well, so it's a hearing that I was involved in. People weren't wearing masks, and there were several people in the room, but I think they were respecting social distancing. But I think it would have been very difficult for them to speak effectively by video with a mask, wearing a mask. So I think from that perspective, you know, as long as they're respecting distances, I think that was okay. And that was their choice to make.
Just one caveat on what I said to clarify, the witness wore a mask until he got to the witness stand and then took off to testify.
So that
the observers in the room were in the back and were all wearing masks and respecting, everybody was respecting social distance.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Emmanuel, what's...
Yes. Same in my hearings. We had, everybody had masks more or less, other than when they spoke at a certain distance. Now, I have to say that I argued for the first time on last Monday before the Paris Court of Appeals, an annulment of awards, and the judges had masks at all times, and all the speaker, all the lawyers on both sides had masks and had to keep them. And that was my first argument with a mask. And I tell you, it makes it shorter. I mean, it's a bit difficult. But, and you cannot breathe up to 5 minutes. But it's, yes, you have to be careful and at least social distancing and mask and all kinds of, you know, protection.
Alex, would you care to comment on the evidentiary hearings in the future held virtually?
Gosh, there's so much ground to cover. But very briefly, I think one, obviously, I will not repeat the points that have been made. Maybe just to build on a couple, there's a sense of formality that sometimes permeates into a virtual hearing. Which may make things a little bit difficult, particularly for those arbitrators or counsel or witnesses, of course, who are less familiarized with the process that in a way becomes our sort of like our bread and butter. So I think there's a shift in culture in a way that is that we are all witnessing right now, and we're not all on the same page yet. There's an issue with regard to tech. There's also an issue of capacity that we also need to take into account. And it's important. And I think it's more important in evidentiary hearings than in deliberations or procedural conferences. It is not, I'm happy to hear about Emmanuel's testimony with regard to an ICC case involving also parties from Africa. But there are jurisdictions around the world where counsel or arbitrators or experts or witnesses of fact will not have adequate capacity to actually participate on an equal footing. And I think obviously when that raises a due process concern, one needs to be careful. So obviously the trend is there. We need to be a little bit, I don't want to overemphasize the point, but we need to be careful in making sure that whatever the new norm is, it is slightly qualified and take into account that not every arbitration, again, involves participants in Paris or New York. Arbitration is now a much more widespread phenomenon than it was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. One point on that I saw actually from a couple of our more recent cases, recent hearings, witnesses of fact, cross of witnesses of fact was actually foregone, especially in complex or long hearings. That ultimately made efficiency because experts were hot-tubbed, even if it is, I think, a little bit more difficult probably to envisage hot-tubbing virtually, at least currently. So that's one additional point. With regard to asymmetrical hearings, Daniel, and I think it goes into the semi-remote hearings also that Emmanuel alluded to earlier, I think one aspect we also need to consider is how do we set them up? And you know, I was looking at one of our bigger rooms at the hearing center, at the ICC hearing center here, and the setting is a setting that considers that takes into account that the tribunal faces cameras and screens, and that counsel sit on opposing sides. And then, of course, there's modalities you can change things around. But you know, when you're looking into semi-remote hearings, for instance, you may have counsel in Paris using the facility and needing to sit there, and maybe a witness somewhere else, or maybe another witness on the other side, or another counsel from the other side. So I think it also allows us to structure or better understand what the practical needs in terms of organizing a hearing will be. And then the last point, I have not seen this, but I have heard many people speak about it, is, and I'm sorry for using another big Greek word, it's asynchronous hearings. Or segments of the hearing. And I think it was Emmanuel who mentioned a moment ago, or maybe you, Daniel, on closing arguments with regard to, you know, that could be done later rather than at the very end of the evidentiary hearing. I think that does create an additional efficiency because then instead of staying, you know, pulling an all-nighter and waiting for the transcript anxiously, which may actually not come, you may actually benefit from a small space of, you know, length of time to actually prepare and reconvene or even record and actually allow arbitrators to process the information when they are ready. I'm not really sure if that is something we will see, but I know I have heard others speak up. We have not seen it in our cases yet, but it might be something that might be added into the toolkit at some point.
Right. I mean, there's certainly a lot of new flexibility that's available. Catherine, did you have views about evidentiary hearings held virtually in the future, even after the crisis is over?
Yeah, so I'll just add a couple of side thoughts for what's said. I guess one vote in favor of human contact. I guess there's a question about the cognition and neuropsychology that comes into actually, you know, physically being in contact with people. So I also teach. And I think that we're finding that online teaching, there really is something different to being in the same room with a teacher. And to the extent that there's an analogy there with dispute resolution, it's not to say there aren't lots of efficiencies and importance, but I do think we'll end up trying to look back on what changes when we don't end up being in the same room. And to the extent that conferences diminish, I mean, this is a very unusual professional community in the sense that our relationships and also exchange of information, I guess, probably won't change so much with Zoom, but happens also in informal conversations at conferences, and relationships are built, you know, in these ever-present, you know, cocktail hours or whatnot. It'll be interesting to see sort of how some of the dynamics within the community might change. I also think, however, though, that Zoom meetings might be something of a great equalizer in the sense that we're all confined to these little boxes. There isn't sort of one grand presence in the room that absorbs everyone's attention. And that might be kind of interesting. Also, in allowing greater participation by younger people who might not be able to travel or whatnot. So I think it creates a number of opportunities, but I think it might have also a human cost. One thing I'll be interested to see, given my specialization in ethics, is I think we might see a reduction in the sort of in-hearing antics, or what we might call misconduct of parties, in the sense that it's much harder to be subtle in interrupting parties on Zoom, your opposing counsel on Zoom, or interjecting, than it is when you're physically in the same room. There might be other types of antics that still apply, but there is a certain orderliness to having it in a Zoom call that I think might bring some discipline to counsel, at least in terms of some of the in-person, what are called often guerrilla tactics. So I think, there are a lot of clearly advantages to having these kinds of hearings, but I think we still will need a longer term, looking back 5 years from now to see, if there aren't also some things that are lost from not being physically together. I think, as I think Nadia referred to earlier, it's really going to also be, I think, largely a function of the amount in dispute. For those larger cases, there will always be, I assume, some sort of in-person aspects to it, even if a little more flexibly. But for the smaller disputes where it's just not, some of these trade-offs might not be worth it, I think that's probably right. And that's what I have to add.
Well, great. And on one of the last points that you made, so the etiquette during virtual hearings, I noticed that a number of procedural orders for virtual hearing procedures address this point and talk about the etiquette and not interrupting each other, and they're actually enforced. So,
That's why, of course, Trump didn't want to have the second debate on Zoom, because he knew he couldn't interrupt Biden all the time.
And Daniel, perhaps if I may just add one thing that will be interesting to see as we develop, as technology develops. I think once we get to the 3D and the hologram type era, I think that's going to be really interesting, because then do you even need to travel? So I think that will be something to watch going forward.
Great. Well, let's move now to the next topic, which is cost and efficiency. Alex, what are your thoughts on the impact of virtual hearings and cost and efficiencies, and what we can learn from that?
Thank you, Daniel. I think very, very quickly, first of all, in terms of travel, because I think that's the way that we premised it originally, if less travel is involved, will that boost arbitrator availability? I think one of the things, and again, Emmanuel alluded to it earlier, that we will see is a questioning, and a healthy one, I hope, as to why does one need to travel in the first place? So what is the intention? What is the act, procedural or substantive, that needs to be carried out and served by my taking a plane and moving, across the seas or the continents to sign terms of reference? To sign procedural order number one. So I think there will be heavy questioning on all sides, and that's why I think it's really going to be a healthy discussion with regard to reassessing what type of travel needs to happen. Now, will that lead to overall availability? I wouldn't necessarily think that the answer is a straight yes, because I think we need to take into account that arbitrators, much as they might be saving time in a given case because of the efficiencies that might be established, will have potentially additional time. So that might either be used to the benefit of the current caseload to explore further any of the points that we have raised before, Kaplan openings, additional mini hearings if that is necessary, a midway, and a number of other things, or they may also be used towards increasing caseload and therefore taking additional cases. And to be completely fair, that is not something that is only tantalizing for arbitrators, but I think equally for counsel. So I think all of this, and in a way, ends up with falls on the back of the client, of the direct user, who's also an important stakeholder. And ultimately, I fear, with regards to an expectation towards institutions, that they will need to deliver again by giving further guidance and tools perhaps with regard to how to tackle that. So again, going back to the point that I raised earlier, we know that in-house counsel tell us that we love arbitration because of predictability and because of cost efficiency. So normally, if one tries to dissect, the arbitration map into small, medium, and large, or uber large cases, I think to the extent that the scale of the hearing and the efficiency that any of the measures we have discussed will actually lead to an analysis that will significantly reduce the cost, then this will be indeed a very important parameter, and we will see changes in both cost and overall efficiency. If, by contrast, one is looking at a multi-billion-dollar case where the cost of the hearing, although significant, is ultimately only a fragment of the overall cost of the arbitration, there I think, and also probably for other reasons, the efficiency that we're talking about will be minimal and ultimately lost, I think. So those would be my very broad comments on this topic.
Okay,
if I may just add one more, sorry, I should have probably started with this. We have not yet concluded, we as the Secretariat of the Court, I mean, of the ICC Court, a full analysis of all the cases that have some sort of impact in terms of process, not of substance with regard to the pandemic. But the first results that we see are the following. We have about one third of the caseload. First of all, we have an exponential rise of pending cases, which is normal, again, because of the fact that a number of procedural calendars needed to be extended, especially during the first months of the pandemic. Ultimately, this may lead to some cost efficiency because the hearings will be done virtual or some parts of the process may be abridged. But of course, the extension of the procedural calendar means more cost. At the same time, we also saw an opposing trend. We also saw cases that actually wrapped up quicker because, to go back to your original question, some arbitrators had free time on their calendars. And that's why we ultimately have scrutinized as many awards as during this time as any in the previous years, which I think is an important lesson. But about one third of the caseload currently has some sort of impact resulting from the COVID pandemic. And that can be extension of procedural timelines to make submissions, extension of timelines to pay, requests to put the matter in abeyance, in suspension, and of course, requests to rethink about either the overall process or the hearing segment of the process. Curiously, the cases that have a very specific issue centered around efficiency of hearings is not that big. It's actually about 100 cases out of 1,800. And again, I say this with a little level of a little pinch of conservatism because I don't have authority to speak on absolute figures yet, but the ballpark figure is there. And we speak about incidents because we speak about a contentious matter. And that takes me back to the original point that I made with regard to this also being a consensual matter. And we do see many parties with arbitrators actually agreeing on the way forward. So let's keep that in mind. And I hope that I'll be able to give you more data when we next meet.
Great. Nadia, do you have any comments or views on cost and efficiencies in those virtual proceedings?
Yeah, I do think it'll be more cost efficient and potentially time efficient to have these virtual hearings, there's no doubt. But I think we shouldn't overstate that either, because sometimes now I find in international arbitration, and I think this resonates with what Alex said, is we're always talking about we should do this because it's going to be so much more time and cost efficient. I think we should look at the case and we should decide for the case whether it's going to be more time and cost efficient, and whether it makes sense for, you know, the big ticket cases to have it, you know, whether it's proportional or not. So we need to look at all those elements. So I think, yes, as a general statement, I think we can say it's going to be more cost and time efficient, but we shouldn't just say it as a blanket statement. We need to look at the cases at hand, right? Because at the end of the day, it's nice to talk about cost efficiency and time efficiency, and those are important to our clients. But the clients also want to be sure that they have been properly heard. And if they are very important cases to them, and usually that's the case when it's the big ticket cases, not only, but often that's the case, they want to make sure that all the stops have been put out and that, you know, and that they have been properly heard. And that also requires sometimes physical presence. So that's what I would say on that. With regard to the point, are arbitrators going to be more available? I would predict that they will not be more available. I think they've been more available maybe during the pandemic because a lot of hearings were canceled in the beginning. And so therefore they had more time and they got on with some of the, you know, awards maybe. But if this becomes a normal, the new normal of having hearings virtually, it just means that they're going, you know, it's human nature. You'll take on probably more cases. I don't think people are going to say, you know what, I have more time now. I'm going to dedicate more time to my cases. People who are doing that, I knew arbitrators that said, I will never take more than X cases because I don't, you know, this many as president and this many as co-arbitrator. And those people will still do it. But other people, and I think that's going to be the majority, going to say, okay, I'll have a little bit more time so I can take more cases on. And I think that's where institutions can make a difference. They're already doing that by looking at the availability of the arbitrators. But I think foremost, it's for counsel advising their clients on the selection of arbitrators to have the discussion with the arbitrator and say, can you tell us what's your workload? You know, what are the deadlines that are coming up? And irrespective of whether it's virtual or in persona, make sure that the arbitrators do have the availability that's required.
Great, thank you. Emmanuel, what are your thoughts on this?
I'd like to, maybe for the sake of the discussion or not, but I'd like to push back a little bit with vis-a-vis what you all said, Catherine started, Alex and Nadia. I find you all extremely conservative because you seem to suggest that for the big cases, we go back to the good or bad old days. And for the small cases, yeah, virtual hearing would be fine. I think that's too simplistic. I think that in the big hearings, you have lots of ancillary witnesses. You have lots of issues that are not core. You may have a hybrid issue, a hybrid approach to things, you may have core people be heard personally, but ancillary witnesses or experts can be done remotely. The experts are throughout the world. There's still a huge waste in these big, big cases. Why should we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in these big cases just because there is a billion in dispute? I mean, I don't think it's right. I think proper case management is to distinguish from the core and what would make a difference. Maybe you have two people disagreeing on the story where they were in the same room at the same time and one says they said X and the other says no, we said something different. Maybe these guys you want to hear in person, and that's key if something turns on it. So maybe, you know, there are other issues, experts who are talking about something which is very, technical, dry, and where the, proper debate will be sort of more orderly and there is no risk of having any interference or any prompting. You know, even in big cases, I would hope that we use the lessons of the pandemics to make them more efficient, because clients are cost conscious even for big cases. That's clear to me.
And Catherine, on cost and efficiency, what are your thoughts on the issues?
So first, I want to thank Emmanuel for calling me conservative. I think that might be the first time anyone has, and I can use that in the future, I think, as a professional opinion to respond to anyone who accuses me.
You can quote me.
Okay, I will quote you. So I'm going to go back to something that Alex said, and that is about predictability and that the parties always want predictability. And that was put on my arbitrator intelligence hat. in that I think one of the things that comes up when you're looking for predictability is when you see a big change in an industry, like how do you measure that also against your expectations based on how it was before? So Arbitrator Intelligence actually has our reports now available for sale. And we have a number of metrics that you can look in our reports and see, including for cases that are not publicly available. I'm not talking about just the investment cases, but in fact, smaller cases. And you can see actual arbitrators' track records. I think particularly as a number of arbitrators who get involved because of the larger number of cases, because there are increasing numbers of smaller cases and intentional efforts to appoint more diverse arbitrators, it's going to be harder to collect this information by phone, which has been the primary mechanism in history. And so these reports are going to be very useful. And the one thing I wanted to add in particular is that we are in the process right now. We collect this information through a confidential online questionnaire called the Arbitrator Intelligence Questionnaire that parties and counsel, not arbitrators, fill out at the end of the case, giving a lot of just very detailed feedback on or information about the case itself, but confidential, so not the parties' names, dates, and whatever, including what kinds of procedural requests were made, what kinds of procedural requests were granted or granted in part and denied in part. And that allows people to do some predictive to increase the predictability, because when you're strategizing your case, it's not just, is this arbitrator someone I know, but what are their past rulings? We are coming out with an AIQ 2.0 soon, and we'll be vetting some of those questions publicly. And among the questions that we're adding, because we've been pressed by a number of different people, is questions about the use of technology and about innovation in procedures that have been a result of kind of the shift that we've been talking about all this time. So we actually, the people who've tuned in as attendees and the people on this panel, certainly I'll hit you up for some feedback about what is the best way to frame those questions? What